This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 98th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super proud to have Bart Miller joining me today. Hi, Bart.
Yeah, good morning, Gary. I'm really pleased to be here.
Bart Miller is a professor of computer science at the University of Wisconsin. He's also chief scientist of the DHS-funded Software Assurance Marketplace, fondly known as SWAMP. Bart got his BA from UC San Diego and an MS and PhD from UC Berkeley. Professor Miller is an ACM fellow and is coiner of the term fuzz testing. His research encompasses binary code analysis, computer security, and software testing, among other disciplines, and he lives in Madison, Wisconsin. So thanks for joining us today, Bart.
Yeah, glad to be here. Finally have some spring weather here.
Let's start with something quasi-topical, the Heartbleed bug and the fallout from that. So one of my two favorite papers about Heartbleed was the one that you wrote with James. You say Kupsch? Is that how you say James?
Kupsch. Yeah, Kupsch. He's my chief analyst. I'm chief staff analyst.
Cool. So that Heartbleed paper that you co-wrote with James. The other one was by Andy Chu from Coverity, by the way. But tell us about the methods you describe in your paper for software assurance and how they worked or didn't work against the OpenSSL code base.
Well, so Heartbleed was a wake-up call for a lot of people that were making assumptions about security of open source software, mm-hmm. which is quite good. I don't want to say anything bad. And it was also a wake-up call for people who were depending upon software assurance tools that do code scanning and looking for flaws in the code. The reason why we're interested in the SWAMP project's goal is to increase software assurance by making lots of software assurance tools available to anybody who's developing software.
Right.
So you can basically upload your software, run a lot of tools against it, or upload your tool and run against a lot of software. So it's kind of a meeting place. That's why the marketplace, uh-huh. Plus educators and researchers. And the thing we were worried about is, why didn't software assurance tools, the current tools, well-known names like Fortify, Coverity, CodeSonar, AppScan, RedLizard, I mean, I can go on and on. Mm-hmm. Why didn't those tools find this vulnerability? And we knew from a long time ago from, Jim Kupsch and I did a study of the effectiveness of software assurance tools against well-known exploitable vulnerabilities, because we do in-depth vulnerability assessments as well.
Yep.
And we always knew there was a gap between there. And so we were surprised to find a simple buffer overflow was missed by these tools.
Yeah. I mean, one of the issues, of course, is that when code is sort of a disastrous mess from a control flow or data flow perspective, it makes the job of some of those tools harder.
Well, it definitely does. There's a lot of complexity in the code, and one of the things we tried to do was study the code carefully from the perspective of knowing how tools work, because we've worked on tools ourselves, knowing how exploits are written, because we've written our own exploits, and looking at it from both the offensive and defensive side. And basically, there's a lot of use of pointers, there's a lot of use of aliasing, where different pointers to data structures mean different things. There's reuse of data structures. Mm-hmm. And there's just an interesting layered upon layer of code complexity. And there's also a lot of cleverness in the code. And I tell my students that cleverness should be severely punished in programming.
I love it. I think that's exactly right.
And in fact, one of the things to look at is, the open source community has a lot of great things going for it. In fact, in our early fuzz testing, we found out the overall reliability of their code was better than the commercial code by far.
Just in terms of fuzzing, so dynamic analysis on.
That's right. In terms of the fuzz testing by that particular measure, Richard Stallman from many years ago, when he was first hanging out at Berkeley when I was a grad student, used to get in loud shouting matches about his views towards ownership of software, lack of it. And once I produced the fuzz results that said open source software and GNU and Linux were better than the commercial software, I was his friend again. So
that probably only lasted a short while.
Well, you know, I try not to argue. So it's clear that there's many good things about open source software. the problem is there's no, to use the term from Eric Schmidt, there's no adult supervision.
Right.
There. And there's a lot of very smart people, but nobody can come in and say, that's just too clever, that's just too cute. And so this code complexity, really hampered the ability of these tools to find the vulnerability. And in fact, you can see that same cleverness in the fix for the remediation for that vulnerability. I mean, it's got this if statement in it, and if you look at the if statement, it just makes anybody with any amount of software background cringe. It says if 1 + 2 + 16 is greater than something. And
you just go, what?
Right, so you're burying magic numbers in your code. It's just an incredible, my students, I teach an undergrad OS course, and they have to check all the return codes from their system calls. Their program can't be turned in. They can't have magic constants buried in their code,
right,
or the code can't be turned in. And this is just basic, basic stuff. And so while the fix is definitely a fix, it's indicative of a need for more discipline in the software engineering process.
I think that's a good way of putting it, but unfortunately the economics of the situation kind of dictate the dearth of adult supervision. It's no accident that, you know, the hard job of reviewing code in a painstaking fashion is something nobody wants to do for free or for fun.
Right. And so actually in our discussions following this up, we had a very interesting the DHS program that funds us, we just had a principal investigators meeting here in Madison last week, mm-hmm. and we ended up with a very interesting discussion about a different kind of tool. Because what I was talking with a researcher, her name is Henny Sipma, who does code analysis tools, good deep semantic analysis tools that you need as the engine to do these kind of assessments. And when you look at these tools, and you look at any kind of these analysis tools, your results come in three flavors. Yes, I know this line of code is safe. No, I know this line of code is not safe. Or I can't tell.
Right.
And there's always that gray zone in the middle. And that gray zone may do to the level of complexity. It may just be too computationally infeasible to do it. It may even be undecidable. It's just, mm-hmm. there's just no possible way to know whether the code's safe or not. Mm-hmm. And the goal of these tools is to shrink that gray zone down to the minimum so you can say yes or no. Now, something that's really interesting is, if, you know, I asked the question, I said, how hard would it be to build a tool that could point out the lines in the code that were in that gray zone?
Right.
And try to give a little bit of explanation of why. And if you remember way back, you know, if you count gray hairs, you can remember way back to the software metrics days of software engineering.
Where, I used to have the Zeus book. It made a really good doorstop and also a lot of metrics in that book.
Absolutely. You know, we used to joke, count semicolons, divide by the number of characters on a line, divide by the, you know, take a square root of the number of plus signs. And, you know, we just make fun of it because it just seems silly. But the intent was absolutely right on. Can I come up with some kind of quantifiable metric about how complicated this code is on some dimension? And so we were actually thinking it would be a very interesting direction for researchers to be able to come up with a class of tools where if you're building a semantic analysis tool and you know, and your tool is sound, which means you know you're coming up with the results you say are true, you know are true, and if you can actually point out the parts in the program that you can't tell, you can start to give feedback to the programmer, and maybe what you should do is modify your code so it's easier to analyze.
Right, we can't
build perfect tools, so maybe we can give the programmer feedback. I mean, the current tools give so many false alarms that it's a little hard to do this unless you start using the tool from the very first day and fix everything you find. And even that's not necessarily okay because you still get some false alarms that you might have to manually quash,
right,
which worries me. So I had the thought of, you know, maybe we should be building a class of tools that say, here's what, how you have to change your code, and then you can come up with something that we can run with current best assurance tools and give you real confident results.
I kind of like that idea, but I also think that you could plus it up with a co-evolutionary tie to a language or a set of languages that are better. So, I mean, one of the ultimate issues about Heartbleed is written in C, and C is a total disaster in the hands of somebody who's trying to be clever. And so there are ways that languages can constrain things. Type safety is one example that make analysis much more tenable. And I think both of those things together might get us somewhere.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, if you look at the history, this C programming language was written at the end of the 1960s. And it was a great follow-on to B, which was its predecessor. but it's really it's a wonderful language. You look, the wonderful thing about C is you look at the code and you know what's going on. You look at C++ code with all its layers of classes and generators and derived type templates. It's just a puzzle to try to figure out what a single line of code means. And so C is very pleasing in the fact that it's just so direct and clear. But on the other hand, its memory system is actually a nightmare. And as you point out, it's got no real strong guarantees of type safety.
Right.
And so now
I think it's what Howie Schrobe calls the sea of bits.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just horrible out there. Now, I mean, it's an interesting question of what would you move to. Certainly, if you move to something like Java or C#, you would get rid of a lot of the memory errors. You have well-defined data structures with balance checking. You have garbage collection. So a lot of the problems that you have in C go away. The higher-level problems, you're still going to get injection
attack. That's right. So they get replaced by problems that are, in some sense, more interesting but also more difficult to find automatically.
Right. But at least we've raised the bottom end of the spectrum up, so we move out of the 1960s, 70s, or 80s. And there's a whole bunch of really cool new languages, Go and Scala and, you know, and Ruby, and the question is, you know, I don't know which, you know, I'm not advocating anyone in particular, but it's really clear that using C, and even C++, because C++ has all of the same memory system with all this incredible other object-oriented syntax thrown on top of it. So C++, used with the basic language types has the same problems.
Absolutely. Plus, it's just impossible to understand, as you pointed out. Let's switch gears a little bit. So you wrote about fuzz testing in 1990, I think based on, as far as I understand, an exercise that you assigned in your operating systems class.
That's right.
And then it turned out that the results were really cool, so then you published it. So can you please explain what fuzz testing is and why it's important for listeners who may not know what that is?
Well, so I mean, I always like to start off because it's figurative and literally. It started on a dark and stormy night, we had a Midwest thunderstorm, one of those thunderbusters. The sky was lighting up, the rain was pouring down, and you couldn't believe what was going on. And I was logged on to my 1200 baud non-error correcting modem to my office back station. And so these are all quaint antique terms to the younger listeners. And we're getting noise on the phone line, and as I was typing, you know, you raise the typing sensible to enter before the noise overwhelms you. But part of the thing that amazed me is programs are crashing. The random junk coming over the phone line was crashing common programs.
It was killing programs, right? And you're like, wait a minute, that's just noise.
That's right. And so we decided to study it systematically, and being a professor and teaching, I was teaching the graduate life course. We hand out many research projects as part of our graduate course and mm-hmm. sort of semester-long project. So I challenge students to systematically study this process. And the important thing about fuzz, so random testing was not a new thing. People had done stuff. There was the monkey that was not very well known, but a really cool tool that the folks at Apple used in the very first Macintosh. But what we were doing was, one is we wanted to study its behavior. So first of all, we built a simple tool, a set of tools that could generate this random out output with various characteristics. Then we complied it to a lot of versions of Unix. It was Unix in the days, not Linux, and a lot of versions of Unix. But the thing that we did was, the thing that convinced people that there was some value here was, not only did we crash a lot of programs, but we took every single crash and categorized the results.
Right, yep, yep.
And so we turned this into more of a science. So we basically could show you in a more quantitative way what you could find with random testing. So basically, so all that being said is, to answer your original question, not to get off the track, is you basically throw a bunch of garbage input at a program. And it might be totally random or it might be slightly structured to fit some protocol, but you throw the garbage input at a program and see if the program explodes.
See if it crashes. So it's black box random testing where the system crashes the observable.
Exactly.
That's completely automated, right?
And yeah, it's completely automated. So you can just set up large scripts. You can test on a regular basis, and it doesn't require any substantial programmer intervention or careful tailoring of the program. So it's really quite flexible and powerful. And what I've learned in the subsequent years, there's a concept amongst intelligence analysts who are trying to build exploits of a concept called owning the bits.
Mm-hmm.
And where I'm approaching a program, and as a user or an attacker, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, and if it's a teenager, it's both. And so I'm approaching a program, and I'm typing in some input. That input's arriving, and I can affect the program through parameters and web forms and environment variables and input files, all sorts of things. That's my, you know, the well-known attack surface.
Right.
And the question is, what part of the internal state of the program am I affecting as the user?
Mm-hmm.
What bits can I manipulate? And I own those bits as the user. I type in BART, and in a buffer appears BART, and that happened because I typed it.
Right.
Now, the goal of the programmer is for me to only own the bits they want me to own. The goal of the attacker is to own more bits. So, for example, if I overflow a buffer onto the stack and put the return address in, like a classic stack smashing attack, you know, then I'm now owning bits on the stack I shouldn't own. I'm owning the return address, controlling the program to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole concept of can I own pieces of the state is important. And what fuzz testing does is it's a flag that says, hey, you're owning bits that you should not own.
Mm-hmm. You made the thing misbehave so badly that it crashed.
Exactly. Sometimes you can own bits. That's a very good distinction, because you can sometimes own bits that change places you're not supposed to change, but somehow has no effect on the program. Maybe the variable is not being used anymore or whatever. So sometimes you can cause misbehaviors that have no visible effect. So what fuzz testing does is it gives you a very fast, very simple approach to say, are there problems in the structural handling of data in this program? Am I handling what the user gives me in a safe way? And once you know the answer is no, then you go into debug mode if you're the programmer, or you go into attack mode if you're the analyst, you know, saying, okay, I know I can manipulate the bits. How can I manipulate them to my particular goals and desires to control this program? And so it's the programmer's goal is to keep those boundaries well defined. The attacker's goal is to manipulate those boundaries to carry out their attack.
So there are ways to make fuzz testing more sophisticated. I don't know if you know this, but I wrote this book a trillion years ago called Software Fault Injection.
And yes, I have seen it. Actually, I've read it. Very good.
You're like one of the 2,000 people that read it. Thank you. So the part of what software fault injection was talking about was changing the observables so that you don't necessarily rely on a crash, which is a very obvious thing and easy to automate, but you can put instrumentation into the code so that you have a different set of observables that you're looking for as you manipulate the input. But this notion of, you know, manipulate input, watch what happens, is just classic testing 101. And I think it's amazing that fuzz testing, which is so simple and so compelling, isn't in more widespread use, because there's so many computers just sitting around doing nothing. We could just have them doing all sorts of fuzz testing all the time.
Well, you know, interesting. I mean, every security analyst I know, the people whose job it is either for offensive or defensive reasons, mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing they do when they approach a new system is fuzz it.
Yeah. Well, I think Charlie Miller owes you royalties, don't you?
Well, if I got points every time somebody used fuzzing, or if I got pennies even, I probably wouldn't have to write any more grant applications.
Exactly. You could just ski all the time or whatever. So Charlie keeps winning CANSEC West, but it's mostly with fuzz testing, from what he explained to me.
Now the thing that's interesting is when we submitted the first fuzz paper, we got raked over the coals.
I love academia. Too useful. Please try again.
Well, they say, well, we like the results, but what's your model? What's your formalism? And I just kept looking at him. I was a really dumb, naive professor. And I go, but we're finding bugs. Is that good?
Listen, we had the same thing when we were sending stuff to Oakland about breaking Java. They were like, what's this got to do with security? And we were like, everything?
That's where we broke in. It's insecure, yes.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. I got a question about fuzzing particular things. So one of the things that we find in the BSIM model is people using fuzzing, so to speak, on APIs that are inside of a piece of code. So you have a component, it has an API, so you build usually a grammar that you can then use for fuzzing in a particular way. Does that fit your definition, or is that just too much manipulation of the term?
Well, you know, it's what I think is really cool is how much fuzzing has grown much bigger than anything we've ever done.
Right.
You know, and in fact, if I can strain my arm a little bit and pat myself on the back, but not too hard, the fact that the field has longer legs is really encouraging. So, you know, people call that, sometimes call it structured fuzzing.
Right.
Where, and in fact, we did a simple version of that when we were testing the very first window-based program.
Yeah, I remember the NT stuff. Yep.
Well, actually, we the NT results were really interesting, but we did in the previous paper, we tested X windows before the NT was really a thing. Mm-hmm. And so we were talking the Windows protocol. And so we were trying to figure out, well, how do we fuzz this protocol? And we tried a variety of different things. And the first one is just send, so you, the window, the X Windows, window server on Unix and Linux basically has an RPC protocol to the server.
Right.
You know, you connect to it and you send packet to a well-known format and you get back responses. And in result, the screen does nice, pretty, sensible things. We just sent the thing random junky packet streams. I mean, just pipe
just
streams.
Just to see what happens. Yeah.
And to see what happens. And we found a certain number of crashes because most of the time people use libraries that don't send random unstructured packet streams.
Yep.
And so we found some. But then we realized if we looked at the control flow of the program, we were reaching very shallowly into the program.
Right.
We're catching all the buffering and formatting, but not the deeper operations. So then we said, well, let's do fuzzing, which is basically monkeys at a keyboard and mouse. So what would be the effect of somebody's hammering away at a keyboard and mouse randomly? Which means now we had to send properly formatted X window packets.
Yeah, but the payload came from the key A or whatever, mouse movement, yada, yada.
Right, exactly. We had to make sure the coordinates of any mouse touch were within the bounds of the window and so on. So even back then we were starting to structure our input, showing
of course, yeah,
to go deeper and deeper into the control flow graph. And then a few years later, the Linux guys built a tool that would actually test the system call function call interface. and they basically would fuzz. They basically fuzz the kernel call interface.
Was that Valgrind?
Pardon?
Is that Valgrind?
No, you know, Valgrind is checking for memory errors in application programs. This is actually just randomly calling the libc functions that involve kernel calls and using a random parameters in each one of them. And they, like you described, they use kind of a, it's almost a little generous to call it a grammar, but a specification for each parameter of its range and how many parameters there were, and tried to see if they could crash the Linux kernel as a result. And it was actually quite effective.
So I presume you're going to put this in this upcoming book about fuzzing. When's that going to be done? And what's it called?
Well, I'm not writing a book about fuzzing. I've left that. There's a whole bunch of other people who have written books. And in fact, I've written the foreword for three or four.
Says there's an upcoming book on the website somewhere.
Yeah, but it's not my book. That's somebody else's.
Okay.
So other people have done that, and
I'm telling you, man, you're never going to get your penny per fuzz, or you know, jillionth of a penny. That's what you need.
Well, if I was in it for the money, I would be.
So you've also done a ton of work with your PhD student and one-time PhD student and now professor at Maryland, Jeff Hollingsworth, on dynamic instrumentation of binaries. So tell us a little bit about that work. And in particular, what aspects of that work do you think would be interesting or informative for security?
Well, so the whole goal is to and this started back in the late 90s, back in the early to mid 90s, is to look at a binary program, parse and analyze it, much like a compiler would look at a source program and parse and analyze it.
Right.
And that's a fairly conventional notion now, but in the 90s, it was really us and the Atom group at DEC that were looking at that in a serious way. And then the goal was also to patch a binary program on the fly while it was running.
Right.
And people thought that was crazy, which means a good research project. And that was the technology we did. And we also went on a few years later with another one of my PhD students, Ari Tamchez, to look at how to patch the kernel on the fly while it was running.
Nice.
And people thought that was really crazy, and it actually worked out quite well.
Yep.
So basically the whole notion is to be able to analyze a binary code, do a deep control and data flow analysis of the code, structurally understand the program, be able to control the program, and then be able to patch it safely while it's running.
Yep.
And now that's gone on to do, we've gone on to two really interesting applications in security and cyber forensics. One is actually watching malware, because malware is defensive. It tries to fight back. It tries to detect you're watching it, and it obfuscates itself horribly. It unpacks itself.
Right.
It manipulates its code on the fly. It uses pointer-based control flow. Uses obscure instruction sequences. So we actually built a version of our binary instrumentation tools, which is called Dyninst, and you can download Dyninst for free. It's open source and use it. That would watch code execute, and any time the program was going off, anytime it couldn't tell what the program was doing, it instrumented it and catch the action. So anytime new code was unpacked, code was modified, unpredictable behavior was going to happen, we caught it before that happened, and we watched it. And the guarantee was that we could analyze and instrument any piece of code before it executed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So if the program is unpacking itself, we were guaranteed we'd see the unpacked code as it appeared, and we could apply our control instrumentation to it. And we'd actually instrument the way in the program so it couldn't tell it was being instrumented. If it was trying to check by doing memory checksums, we defeated the checksum automatically.
Right.
If it was checking to see if the debugging flag was on, we'd turn the debugging flag off.
Well, it's kind of like the brain in the vat, and you're the malicious demon, so
absolutely.
You win.
Absolutely. So we actually built a version that could run against packers. And by doing it from first principles, it didn't really make a difference which packer it was, where we could actually watch an instrument and follow the code. And this is Kevin Roundy's dissertation, which we call the hybrid analysis of malware.
Mm-hmm.
So one direction. The other direction was looking at binary code and saying who did it, who wrote
it. Right. Yep.
And we looked at starting by using advanced machine learning techniques, saying can we look at the binary code and tell which language each module is written in, which compiler, which optimization level, which version of the compiler, and those things were all pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you can say this was compiled, this was assembled, this was built by hand, blah, blah, blah.
Right. But then the big question we asked, and this is work I did with my student Nate Rosenblum, we asked, could you tell the author of the code by looking at the binary?
Yep.
You know, because we all know programmers have style. If you worked in a group for a while, you look at so-and-so, and you go, oh, that's Larry's code, that's Susie's code. You know people's style. And our hypothesis was that the authorship signal, that style, would be maintained through the compiling, through the optimization, through the linking process, through stripping off all the symbols and all the symbolic names. And it turned out, doing some really interesting compute-intensive machine learning techniques. My colleague Jerry Hsu worked with Nate and I on this, and we found good, strong authorship signal in binary code.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, in geopolitical terms, it'd be hilarious to see if there was Russian code versus code from the Philippines versus Chinese code in the malware pile.
In fact, this is a very interesting question to analysts. I mean, because bad guys assemble modules from well-defined marketplaces. Yep. You know, your SLED code, your implant, your XFIL code.
Yep.
And the question, and if you can look at each of those modules and figure out an author assignment, you can start drawing social networks of bad actors.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually start tracing back sources and who's working with whom and whose work is moving from across which boundaries. You can also use it for more mundane things like intellectual property rights arguments.
Right,
Is that my function stuck in your product?
Where'd you get my function? I can show that it's mine. One last topic, even though we're going long, but that's cool because this is very interesting. You're the chief scientist of the Swamp Project. So
Yes. You
sort of explain what Swamp is about at the top. But who is using Swamp right now? I mean, is it in beta mode? And how does it compare with existing commercial solutions that people pay tons of money for?
Well, to answer your last question first, one of the differences is you don't pay any money for it.
So that's free.
So the goal of Swamp is to bring together a large collection of software assurance tools. Mm-hmm. And we're starting with static analysis tools that are doing source and bytecode. We'll go to various dynamic tools, mobile tools, web tools, and so on.
Are you using the commercial tools inside of the Swamp? Are they letting you do that? Or are you doing stuff like, I don't know, what was...
PMD, find bugs, clock...
Yeah, find bugs. That's what I was thinking.
CLint, CVP check. Yes. So the answer is we're starting with all the open source tools.
Right.
And we're in discussions with several of the commercial vendors, and until we get to release their tools, I can't say which ones. But there's actually an interesting model where we're trying to get some of the some because DHS is going to fund them, uh-huh. and some because they decide it's good exposure for people to uh-huh. help see their tools.
Uh-huh.
But the basic thing you go to these software assurance meetings and you've heard it and say every tool is good at different things. You know, you look at 10 different tools, whether it's open source or commercial tools, and the tools are all good at different things. And so the thing we want to offer is not a single instrument, but a symphony. The idea of taking the results from a large collection of tools and automatically getting your application program run against all those tools and get a nice, clean, merged result.
I love the vision, but I worry about the eighth grade band phenomenon.
Well,
to take your analogy and make it mean.
Well, I'm hoping. Well, one of the other goals of the Swamp is because our application packages are not just applications, but reference packages like from NIST,
mm-hmm.
like the Julia test set and ARC, and various calibration sets, plus running against certain sound tools. You, as a tool writer, can tune up your instrument, and so you can run against known code bases. You can run against unknown code bases and compare yourself to other tools.
Right, right. That's very helpful.
So this becomes a vehicle for the quality of tools group. Now, the other thing I really like is you're an assistant professor. You have a really cool idea, and you want to develop an analysis that does one good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't build a general purpose tool, so nobody's going to ever use it. But if you bring it into the Swamp and add it to the analysis, now that one good thing you do will be better for every user of the Swamp.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we allow people to make incremental contributions without having to build the entire complex infrastructure they need to build a tool that somebody else will use.
Cool.
So that's our goal. We also want to make researchers happy to understand the process of analysis so they can study all of our assessment data because we keep everything. We want to bring students and classes in. We have some high school students who are using the swamp.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. So one last question from a technical perspective. What makes computer security different than other kinds of software testing? That is, testing for software security different than other aspects of software testing?
I think it's the fact that we have an active adversary. We have a malicious adversary. For software testing, we're victims of our own carelessness, schedules, maybe lack of skill, maybe too much skill. But in security, there are adversaries out there with infinite time and resources. Infinite resources because there may be just tens of thousands of hobby hackers out there who are smart and who have infinite time. Infinite resources because there are well-funded bad guys and good guys who have the resources. Mm-hmm. And so we're truly fighting about testing. Testing is a safety mechanism where security is really, battle, mm-hmm. a battleground.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great answer. Okay, and then last question, which has nothing to do with anything. It's just, which is more fun, scuba or skiing?
I've often thought about a way of combining those, but I never came up with it.
You really should. There should be a way to ski down a cliff and then land in a lake with all your gear on.
Well, right now skiing gets the slight nod.
Because you're coming out of winter.
That's right. That's
right. Cool. Well, hey, it's a great honor to chat with you today. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really enjoy your podcast. Looking forward to listening to more of them.
Cool. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The May-June issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine features the famous Oakland S&P Symposium in an issue edited by Terry Benzel. The issue also includes our conversation with Yoshi Kono from the University of Washington. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.